Chapter 3. Decoding Identity. Welcome back to the Fertility Clinic. The year is 2035. When you were here 10 years ago, you went through the IVF and embryo screening process to make sure your beautiful daughter was not born with terrible single-gene mutation diseases. That daughter is now 10 and flourishing, giving you a lot of faith in the role embryo screening can play in enhancing a child's health. Watching her and the other children stream out of school at the end of each day, you've also felt sorry for the kids born with genetic abnormalities that could have been avoided had the parents conceived in a lab rather than by selfishly indulging in the random and dangerous conception method of sex. Raising your daughter over the past 10 years, you've paid special attention to the growing stream of discoveries that identify the roles multiple genes play in an increasing number of disorders and traits. You're back in the same fertility clinic you visited a decade ago, walking from the same waiting room into the same doctor's office, but a lot feels different. "Doctor," you say, entering her office, "it's nice to see you. I had such a great experience with IVF and embryo selection last time, I'd like to do it again." The office, like the waiting room you've just left, feels much more comfortable than a decade ago. The antiseptic white of the walls has been replaced by soft pastels of light blue and lavender. The chairs have gone from industrial to contemporary. The office smells faintly of roses. The doctor rises to greet you with a warm smile. "Well, that's what everyone says. Can I offer you a cappuccino?" The question startles you. Since when do they offer barista service at doctor's offices? It seems assisted reproduction has become a competitive customer service business since you were last here. Can you make it decaf? "This is going to be a relatively easy process," the doctor says, then turns her head a moment to dictate your order to her coffee machine. "You were ahead of the game a decade ago when you decided to have us fertilize 10 of your eggs." "I've been sleeping a little easier these past years because I knew the other 9 embryos were still frozen. It's hard to imagine I was ever even considering other options. I wasn't sure I even wanted another child, but these past couple of years I haven't been able to escape the feeling that having another is what I need to do." "And we'll do everything we can to help turn that feeling into a bubbly, angelic reality. Sugar? Just a teaspoon, please. So here is my recommendation," the doctor says, walking over with the teal ceramic mug. "Let's thaw out 6 of your 9 remaining embryos and then extract 5 cells from each using PGT, just like we did last time." "Okay," you reply. The doctor hasn't lost the no-nonsense approach you remember from a decade ago. "Then we'll sequence those cells from each of those 6 embryos and let you know which of those potential children would be carriers of the single-gene diseases, just like last time." "Sure," you say confidently, taking a sip of your coffee. "It's perfectly brewed. You've been through this process before, so you feel confident you know what to expect." "But a lot has also changed since a decade ago," the doctor continues. She leans toward you. "In those early days, we could only screen for single gene mutation disorders and a few simple traits like gender and hair and eye color. Now, we've learned a lot more about the patterns of multiple genes that can lead to more complex genetic disorders, some of which may not show up until significantly later in life. Because these patterns vary from person to person, and because we still don't fully understand the hugely complex whole genome, we can only see this kind of analysis as predictive. We're no longer dealing with binary outcomes, the on-and-off switch for single-gene mutation diseases and disorders we talked about a decade ago. We'll just be able to make percentage predictions, like there's about a 70% chance a child born from one embryo, for example, would get disease X before he or she is Y years old. It wouldn't mean that the potential child would get that disease, just that someone with his or her genetics would have that chance of getting it. Of course, this wouldn't account for environmental factors a child would experience after he or she was born, Does that make sense? Yes, you say, a little more cautiously. These are uncharted waters. But we are able to make these kinds of predictions for many of the most serious and painful diseases that are influenced by genetics. Alzheimer's, heart disease, some cancers. You won't be able to prevent all those diseases through embryo selection, but you certainly can improve the odds of your future child for delaying or avoiding them. A lot really has changed, you say. I'm required by law to ask if you want this predictive information. You obviously have the right to refuse it. If you'd like the information, you'll need to sign the form on this tablet. You think, for just a moment, pick up the stylus, and sign. Why wouldn't you want that information? You have to implant one of the embryos anyway. Why not pick the one with the greatest chance to live a healthy life? The law also requires me to ask you specifically if you would like to know more about the likelihood that your embryos, if they are implanted and taken to term, would express other non-disease-related traits. It's entirely up to you. You feel your spine inadvertently stiffen as you begin to comprehend the question. You sense you know the answer, but ask anyway. What types of traits? Some of the most popular are the patterns of genes suggesting a greater chance to live a longer, healthier life. That seems like a no-brainer, you say, relieved. Isn't living a long and healthy life what this process is all about? You ask yourself. That's good. Some people get nervous the further we get from preventing disease. So many diseases are correlated with age, so if we want to fight disease, we also need to defend our children against aging. Some of those other people think doctors like you are playing God, you say. The doctor smiles wistfully at the suggestion. Some people certainly feel that assisted reproduction is going too far, that we're giving people choices that nature, or whatever deity they trust, didn't want us humans to have. That's why it's so important to find out what each prospective parent is comfortable with. You tell us what works for you, so we can help you achieve it. I would have had a lot more qualms when I came in a decade ago, but now I see not selecting the embryos with the greatest chance of a long and healthy life is like taking something away from my future child. It doesn't feel like I'm adding healthy years to his or her life, but preventing them from being taken away. You lift the stylus to sign again. The doctor gives a hand signal for you to wait. Longevity is just one of the genetic screens. We can also very accurately predict height. Should I go on? I read that tall people have higher incomes and tend to have more self-esteem than short people. Is that true? Most of the studies suggest that. Do a couple of inches of height mean so much to you that you'd choose a different embryo to get it? But then, all of these embryos are your potential natural children, so why not try to pick a taller one if all other things are equal? Picking a taller future child, you explain to yourself, is the same as not picking a shorter one. You take in a deep breath. Why not? What's the big deal? I'm already selecting for so many other things. The stylus is feeling heavier, but you lift it again. The doctor again raises her hand gently. The next screen is IQ, she says softly, but with more gravitas. She clearly recognizes the implications of her words. You've seen the news articles, but something still feels uncomfortable about choosing the potential IQ of your future child. How accurate is the test? You ask, stalling for time. Can we really know something like that? It's all probabilities, but we're getting better at making these kinds of predictions. IQ isn't all about genetics. How you raise and educate your child still means a lot. But IQ is a mostly genetic characteristic, particularly as we age. But will my child be happier if he or she has a higher IQ? No one really knows, the doctor says. IQ is still controversial. Many people say it's culturally biased. But society itself may be culturally biased, so I'm not sure where that leaves us. And there's no denying the correlation between IQ and lots of other important life outcomes. You inhale again. Do you really want to be in the business of choosing your future child's brain function? You ask yourself. If you don't optimize your child for IQ, will she love you or hate you for it? Repeated studies from around the world have shown that people with higher IQs tend to live longer on average than people with lower IQs, she adds. How do they know that? You ask cautiously, a hint of humanist suspicion in your voice. Lots of ways. The Scottish government gave IQ tests to all 11-year-olds in Scotland on a single day in the 1930s. 6 decades later, researchers began correlating the IQs from the tests and those children's life experiences. Even when they controlled for social class and lots of other factors, the outcome still showed that the higher IQ kids on average lived longer. Scores of additional studies have shown the same thing. But IQ isn't just one thing. How can they really know? You ask, not wanting to reduce the identity of your future child to survey results. You're right. IQ is a complicated concept many people reject. Some people even say a high IQ doesn't even make you smart. And if someone has a high IQ, does that make them a better artist, a more loyal friend, a more loving father or mother? You ask. Those are all the right questions. The answer to all of them is no. There's no evidence of any of that. But there's a lot of statistical research suggesting that high IQs strongly correlates with success in school, career, wealth creation, and sociability. You feel yourself relenting in spite of yourself. You know IQ doesn't measure everything, and that a human is so much more than a simple IQ score. But are you prepared to reject the concept of IQ out of hand and leave it to your future child to suffer the consequences if you are wrong? That would also be a risk. If you don't select the embryo with the highest IQ, it's not at all certain the embryo you select will have a greater genetic predisposition to being a better artist or a more compassionate person. For all you know, those qualities might, like so much else, also be positively correlated with IQ. But a twinge in your gut also tells you there's something wrong. Not about choosing an embryo with a relatively higher IQ than the others, but about not choosing your higher IQ embryo. This is not the most politically correct thought you've ever had, but now, you realize, is a moment for brutal honesty. You squeeze the stylus between your fingers and look up. There's more, the doctor continues, a grave look crossing her face. I need to tell you about some of the latest research on personality styles. Personality styles? You repeat, a lump forming in your throat. What is left of the mystery of being human? I imagine you know people in your life who are more extroverted than others. Oh yeah, you say, thinking of your sister. And people who are more open or more neurotic? I do. Her husband, and now, after only 6 months of puppyhood, their overfed and skittish dog. Or even people who are sadistic and cruel. Your mind shifts to your angry neighbor you saw yesterday kicking his malfunctioning sprinkler bot. Personality style has many foundations, the doctor continues, but genetics is probably the biggest. Wait a second, you say, feeling another tug at your humanity. You're telling me I can select which of these little embryos in your freezer is going to be the next Mother Teresa and which is the next Jeffrey Dahmer? The doctor can't seem to decide if you're joking, but plays things cautiously. She walks over and sits in the chair beside you. What I'm saying, she says softly, enunciating each word, is that we are beginning to understand the genetic patterns underlying different personality styles, and people who want that information when selecting which of their embryos to implant are entitled to it by law, provided they sign a waiver before getting that information. A person's personality comes from so many different sources, you say, still trying to hold on to the magical unknown of being human. How can you reduce all of that to genetics? We can't, the doctor replies. Full stop. She pauses a moment to let her point settle. but we can offer statistical probabilities. If you choose to do so, you have the ability to select the embryo from among your six that has the highest statistical likelihood relative to the others of having whichever personality style you choose. "Something doesn't seem right about that," you say. "It feels like I'd be ordering my child from Starbucks. Light on the milk, extra shot of espresso, 3 pumps of mocha." "I'm not here to convince you one way or another," she says, leaning back. "I'm just explaining your options. It's really up to you." Now your mind is racing. You think back to your own childhood, how surprised your parents were that you were so great at math when neither of them could balance a checkbook. You remember how proud you felt overcoming your shyness to sing in your school talent show. You remember all of the unknown mysteries that unraveled over the course of your life. Would you have felt the same if your parents had selected options for you off a menu? Would they have been as happy when you sang in the talent show, or just known you would do it because you had already been genetically optimized for extroversion? But then again, you counter in your head, all of these embryos are my natural children. One of them will be born into a world where other parents are making these same decisions. If I'm going to invest the coming decades of my life in helping my future child flourish in every way, why wouldn't I pick the embryo with the best shot? You feel your arm quivering. Your hand inadvertently squeezes the stylus ever harder. To sign or not to sign? That is the question. The more we understand about how our genetics work, the better able we will be to select for more traits and more genetically complex traits in our future children. While we must always be humble about the limits of our knowledge, we are also an aggressive and hubristic species that has always pushed our limits. As our ancestors developed the brain capacity that made group hunting, language, art, and complex social structures possible, we began developing the tools to change the environment around us. When we developed agriculture, cities, and medicine, we gave the middle finger to nature as we had found it, and it had found us. But even then, the kinds of choices made in our hypothetical fertility clinic will still require that we figure out how much of what we are stems from our innate biology and how much comes from the broader environment around us. If a disease or a trait is only minimally genetic, selecting it during IVF and PGT makes little difference. For dominant single-gene mutation diseases like Huntington's disease or genetic traits like eye color, genes are almost entirely determinative. Lung cancer acquired from a lifetime of smoking, on the other hand, is not. Fixing our genetic diseases and potentially selecting genetic traits requires that we first figure the extent to which we and each of our disorders or traits are determined by our genes. The process of assessing where biology ends and the environment begins is just another way of describing our age-old debate on the balance between nature and nurture. Our forebears have debated this for millennia. Plato believed that humans are born with innate knowledge, an assertion later challenged by his star pupil Aristotle, who argued that knowledge is acquired. Confucius famously wrote in the 6th century BC, "I am not one who was born in the possession of knowledge," casting an unwitting vote for Aristotle. In the 17th century, Descartes expressed his Platonic belief that human beings are born with certain innate ideas that undergird our general approach to and attitude toward the world. Hobbes and Locke, on the other hand, believed that lived experience exclusively determined the characteristics of a person. Almost everyone these days would agree that the answer to the nature versus nurture debate is both, because nature and nurture are both dynamic systems continually interacting. That this is undoubtedly true doesn't make figuring out how genetically determined we are any less important. This is not just a philosophical question. If we are mostly nature, If our genetics in major ways determine who we are, then fixing a problem or making a change would need to happen on a genetic level. If we are mostly nurture, mostly influenced by the environmental factors around us, then we'd be crazy to think about altering our complex genetics to change outcomes when more benign environmental changes could do the trick. It's impossible to draw an exact line between nature and nurture, but generations of twin studies have helped scientists understand the role genetics play in influencing who we are. Identical twins separated at birth provide a particularly great opportunity to better understand the role of genetics. The bigger the role genetics play, the greater the likelihood identical twins raised apart will wind up similar to each other. Identical twins are almost entirely genetic carbon copies of each other at birth. So if humans were 100% genetic beings, these twins would remain fully identical throughout their lives. Schizophrenia in twins is a good test case. About half of identical twins share this chronic brain disorder, compared to less than 15% of fraternal twins, suggesting that schizophrenia has a significant genetic foundation. But because all identical twins don't share the condition, we know that significant environmental and other non-genetic factors are also involved. Psychologist and geneticist Thomas Bouchard's multi-decade study of twins separated at birth found that identical twins raised separately had about the same chance of sharing personality traits, interests, and attitudes as identical twins raised together. We've all heard the incredible stories of identical twins separated at birth who reunite later in life to find they are shockingly similar. Identical twins Jim Lewis and Jim Springer were separated when they were only 4 weeks old. When they met again 39 years later, in 1979, they found they both bit their nails, had constant headaches, smoked the same brand of cigarettes, and drove the same style of car to the same Florida beach. These stories are not mere anecdotes, but indicators of a deeper genetic message. Although the twin studies demonstrated that similarities between twins have more to do with genetic and biological factors than with environmental ones, this did not at all negate the critical importance of love, parenting, family, and all types of nurture. Scores of studies like this have been carried out around the world. In 2015, an enterprising collection of scientists, using findings from most of the twin studies of the previous 50 years, tried to draw conclusions from a mind-boggling collection of 2,748 research publications, exploring 17,804 traits among 14,558,903 pairs of twins in 39 different countries. Using big data analytics to better pinpoint the balance between genetic and environmental influences, they confirmed that all of the measured human traits are at least partly heritable, but some more than others. At the high end, the measured neurological, heart, personality, ophthalmological, cognitive, and ear, nose, and throat disorders were found to be mostly genetic. Across all traits, the authors found that the overall average heritability of all of the measured traits was 49%. If these findings are correct, humans are about half defined by our genetics. This would be good news for classicists. Plato and Aristotle were both correct. That we are, overall, probably about half nature and half nurture intuitively feels right. Most parents say they immediately sensed their newborn child had a sunny, anxious, or stormy disposition. Part of this, I am sure, is historical revisionism after a child grows up optimistic, nervous, or belligerent, but part of it is also our recognition that a big part of who we are is based on the biology we inherit. Assuming for the moment that we are about half nature, with some traits being more genetic than others, how far might we go in understanding that genetic and biological part of ourselves? We know from our intuition and from the research that height is a predominantly genetic trait, but not always. Protein, calcium, and vitamins A and D are essential to helping children grow to their potential. When a disastrous famine struck North Korea in the 1990s, widespread malnutrition stunted the growth of a generation of young North Koreans. The older North Koreans, who had come of age prior to the famine, were closer to the average South Korean height. But the younger North Koreans who grew up in the 1990s are up to 3 inches shorter than their South Korean counterparts. This tells us that, whatever your genes might predict, height can be stunted if you don't get the nutrients you need as a child. If height is mostly genetic, the next step is to figure out which genes have the most to say about how tall we are. There are a small number of single genetic mutations that can make a person very tall or very short. A mutation in the FBN1 gene, for example, can cause Marfan syndrome, a condition that usually makes people very tall and thin with an extra long arm span. Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps and U.S. President Abraham Lincoln both showed symptoms of this mutation. Achondroplasia, on the other hand, is a mutation in the FGFR3 gene that causes short limb dwarfism. But examples like these of single gene mutations having a major impact on height are extremely rare. In most cases, height is influenced by hundreds or even thousands of genes, as well as by environmental factors like nutrition. Experts believe that about 60 to 80% of the difference in height between people is based on genetics. This makes intuitive sense. A person is generally not tall because he or she has one single elongated part, like the neck of a giraffe. Instead, we are tall because each part of us is a little longer. So far, about 800 different genes believed to influence height in one way or another have been identified. Although the full list of genetic height determinants has not yet been uncovered, Stephen Sue, a theoretical physicist and vice president for research at Michigan State University, has done incredible work demonstrating how height can be accurately predicted with only the known genetic factors. Drawing on 500,000 sequenced genomes from the UK Biobank, Sue and his collaborators sought to predict the height of people based on their genetics alone. Once these calculations were made, they compared genetic predispositions to the people's actual height. Remarkably, they were able to, on average, predict from their genetic data the actual height of a person within about an inch. Predicting someone's height from their genetics is useful for catching growth issues early in a child's life, but the stakes of this research are considerably higher. Being able to predict this one complex trait opens the door to the possibility of understanding, predicting, selecting, and ultimately altering any complex trait and many complex and heritable genetic diseases. Sue and others have already applied similar computational algorithms to predicting heel bone density, and this approach is being used to predict partial genetic predispositions to diseases like Alzheimer's, ovarian cancer, schizophrenia, and type 1 diabetes, and other polygenic traits, once the sequenced genomes of enough people with each disease and trait have been entered into a shareable database. It makes sense that predicting a trait that is entirely genetic would be easier if the trait is influenced by just a few genetic markers rather than hundreds or thousands. That's why we need bigger data pools to predict more complex traits than we do for the genetically simpler ones. If a trait is only part genetic, on the other hand, we can only use genetic data sets to predict its heritable portion. If we have both a sense of how heritable a given trait is and a rough guess of the number of genes influencing the trait, we can then begin to estimate how many people's sequenced genomes and life records would be needed to predict the genetic portion of that trait from genetic data alone. For most common adult chronic diseases, this number is estimated at around 1 million. For many psychiatric diseases, it is estimated at about 1 to 2 million. Most complex and polygenic traits can probably be well predicted from overall data sets in the low millions. The larger the quality data sets, the better. Height and genetic disease risks are extremely complex and mostly genetic traits. But intelligence, among the most important and complex of all human traits, will be even tougher to tackle. As long as the concept of intelligence has existed, people have debated what it is and how to measure it. General intelligence is extremely difficult to define, even though many people have tried. The ability to reason, plan, solve problems, think abstractly, comprehend abstract ideas, learn quickly, and learn from experience captures a lot, but also misses a lot. Intelligence, like all traits, is only valuable within a particular context, and there are about as many different types of intelligence as there are people. No one is smart, beautiful, or strong in absolute terms. Take someone out of their environment, and their form of intelligence may be less or more valuable. Albert Einstein was smarter than most of us, but I'm not entirely sure if his type of brilliance would help to find food or water at a time of scarcity. But although it is politically tempting to argue that any ranking of intelligence constitutes inherent discrimination, our progress as a species demands that we both rank intelligence in general and for specific tasks, and that we do our best to ensure that the most capable people are doing the tasks they are best suited for, lest we have our abstract artists running our nuclear power stations. In a world where people's genetic capacities might be matched to their roles, and where general intelligence might be prioritized, we would, by definition, need to respect many types of intelligence so we can maximally benefit from this diversity, while better realizing our own humanity. Saying that intelligence is diverse, however, cannot prevent our recognition that many of its forms are also hierarchical, especially within particular contexts. Perhaps more than most every other trait, the battle has long been waged about the heritability of intelligence. In the later 1800s, the English scientist and polymath Sir Francis Galton, whom we will meet again later when we explore the travesty of eugenics, attempted to measure and compare the sensory and other qualities of British noblemen with commoners. This biased effort to demonstrate the gentry's genetic superiority went nowhere, but highlights that the very idea of intelligence testing was fraught from the start. A couple of decades later, the French psychologist Alfred Binet designed a series of questions for children to determine which needed special help in school. Based on the belief these questions were ones the average student could answer, those children not able to answer the questions were considered to possess lower-than-average intelligence. This idea of having a standard average intelligence with people either above or below that bar was further developed by the German psychologist William Stern, who fixed that average intelligence quotient, IQ, at 100. If someone had an IQ of 120, they would, according to this model, have a 20% higher IQ than the average. An IQ of 80 would be 20% lower. American psychologist Charles Spearman recognized that children's cognitive abilities correlated across multiple subjects, that ones who did well in one area tended to do well in others, and created the concept of a general factor intelligence. Over the ensuing years, the concept of IQ spread rapidly around the world and was used in countless organizations, most famously the U.S. military during World War I, to assess a general aptitude applicable to multiple tasks. Although IQ tests probably did help the U.S. military measure certain types of aptitude, the outcome of tests showing IQ disparities between groups, ominously, were also used by some high-profile scholars like Princeton's Carl Brigham to argue that immigration and racial integration would weaken the American gene pool. Despite this questionable background, IQ, as many studies have shown, and as our hypothetical fertility doctor explained, correlates well with a person's health, education level, prosperity, and longevity. Many of the general cognitive abilities most beneficial to our ancestors, including memory, pattern recognition, language ability, and proficiency at math, are positively correlated, and people with high IQs tend to score well on most other cognitive tests. For many critics, however, IQ remains self-validating, inaccurate, disrespectful of difference, racially and socioeconomically biased, dangerous, and overall highly questionable. This debate reached a fever pitch in the United States following the publication of the 1994 book The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life by Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, which described intelligence as the new dividing line in American society. At the start of the book, the authors take the defensible position that general factor cognitive ability can be reliably measured, differs between people, and is somewhere between 40% and 80% heritable. Although Herrnstein and Murray recognized that intelligence has both genetic and environmental components, they controversially suggested that genetics explains why some groups score lower than others on IQ tests, and that restricting government incentives for poor women to procreate would increase average IQ in the United States. By simultaneously raising the taboo topics of intelligence differences between people and groups, IQ, and race, Herrnstein and Murray smashed into the buzzsaw of progressive public opinion. New York Times columnist Bob Herbert called The Bell Curve a scabrous piece of racial pornography masquerading as serious scholarship. Harvard's Stephen Jay Gould, a longtime critic of the concept of general factor intelligence, argued that other environmental factors like prenatal nutrition, home life, and access to quality education had a more significant influence on a person's intelligence than Herrnstein and Murray accounted for. Other critics attacked the book as reductionist, scientifically sloppy, and dangerously biased. Even in this highly contentious environment, however, a significant number of researchers sought to defend the principle that general cognitive ability was largely genetic and heritable, while trying their best to avoid the clear danger of linking the science of genetics with the contentious politics of race and gender. 52 leading professors published a joint statement in the Wall Street Journal in December 1994, asserting that intelligence can be defined and accurately tested, that it is largely genetic and heritable, and that IQ is strongly related, probably more so than any other single measurable human trait, to many important educational, occupational, economic, and social outcomes. Although Herrnstein and Murray were in many ways flawed messengers, making some scurrilous policy recommendations, the idea that IQ had a real, measurable, and heritable genetic component was harder to dispel. Identical twin and other sibling studies have for decades helped illustrate how much of our IQ is based on our genes versus our experience. The Minnesota Twin Family Study, conducted between 1979 and 1990, followed 137 pairs of twins, 81 identical and 56 fraternal, separated early in life and raised apart. Similar to the findings of the researchers on the genetic makeup of height, the Minnesota scientists found that 70% of IQ was based on genetics, with only 30% resulting from different life experiences, a finding in line with many other twin studies. A more recent literature review of many different studies on the genetics of intelligence estimated IQ to be about 60% heritable. Because IQ is a measure of something expressed and realized as we learn and grow, which is why we don't do IQ tests on newborns, the genetic heritability of IQ tends to increase as people get older. Nevertheless, the very concept of an even partly genetic-based IQ remains sensitive. Questions have repeatedly been raised about whether research like the Minnesota Twin Family Study might have had a socioeconomic bias. In 2003, University of Virginia psychology professor Eric Turkheimer decided to test whether the same percent heritability of intelligence held as true for poorer people as it did for the more middle-class groupings of twins tested in many of the other studies. Interestingly, he found that genetic predictors of IQ were less accurate for children from less advantaged families. One explanation for this could be that IQ tests are fatally biased and flawed. Another might be that negative environmental factors had a greater relative impact than positive ones in these disadvantaged situations, similar to how the food scarcity in North Korea made environmental factors more important for children born in the 1990s than for the rest of the population. If we accept the findings of the vast majority of studies that IQ is mostly but not entirely genetic, the question then becomes, how can we understand the specific genetics underlying IQ? To answer this question, scientists have carried out a large number of studies over recent years trying to identify the thousands of genes influencing IQ. Although only a few genetic variants linked to higher-than-average intelligence had been identified as of 2016, nearly 200 have been identified since that time. While this progress is astounding, each of the identified genes and gene variants accounts for only a tiny percentage of the estimated IQ differences between people. Identifying a few hundred genes out of the potentially thousands that impact intelligence tells us very little about an actual or potential person's intelligence in the grand scheme of things. And yet, that we are identifying these genes at such a rapid clip at an early stage of the genetic revolution strongly suggests we will find even more as the number of people sequenced and access to their life records increases, computing tools and big data analytic capabilities expand, and more money, people, and educational, business, and governmental resources are being brought to bear. The total number of genes influencing IQ would, by definition, need to be significantly fewer than 21,000, the number of genes in the human genome. Our path to identifying the 200 genes has accelerated exponentially in the past few years, so even a number in the low thousands appears reachable. Major progress has been made in cracking the genetic code of IQ, and we still have a long way to go. But how much more genetically complicated is IQ than height? 2 times more? 3 times more? 5 times? It is certainly not 10 times more complex. Steve Sue's preliminary analysis and the impressive work of biostatistician Yang Zhang and her colleagues at Johns Hopkins University suggest that most traits having an average heritability of 50% or higher could be predicted with relative accuracy once we have about 1 million people with their sequenced genomes and life records accessible. Let's say for the moment that human intelligence is 5 times more complicated than Su and Zhang account. That would mean 5 million sequenced genomes and records. That is a lot of people by today's standards, but not compared to the 2 billion people likely to be sequenced over the coming decade. Perhaps an even more complicated human trait to understand and quantify is personality style. Personality is among the most intimate human traits, which is why you gulped when the fertility doctor raised it as an option for selection. Although tests like Myers-Briggs have attempted to quantify different personality styles, the process still seems more an art than a science. A leading theory of personality, dating from the 1950s, divides human personality styles into 5 major categories: extroversion, neuroticism, openness, conscientiousness, and agreeableness. Each of us, of course, is somewhere along the spectrum of each of these styles, and measures like these are necessarily relative and subjective. But we can all easily rank our friends and family members from most to least extroverted, neurotic, etc., so the categories are certainly not meaningless. Per usual, the twin studies also have a lot to say about personality style. On multiple measures of personality and temperament, occupational and leisure time interests, and social attitudes, the Minnesota twin researchers remarkably found, monozygotic, identical, twins reared apart are about as similar as are monozygotic twins reared together. The effect of being reared in the same home is negligible for many psychological traits. Twin studies aren't the only way researchers are digging into the genetics of personality style. Scientists at the University of California, San Diego, brought together data to compare hundreds of thousands of people's genomes to information those same people provided in questionnaires about their personality styles in a study reported in 2016 in the journal Nature Genetics. When they compared the sequenced genomes of people who described themselves as having similar personality types, the researchers identified 6 genetic markers that were significantly associated with personality traits. Extroversion was associated with variants in genes WSD2 and PCDH15, and neuroticism with variants in the L3MBTL2 gene. From just looking at a few points in the genome, the UC San Diego researchers felt they could loosely predict what personality style a person would have. There is almost no chance that our complex personality styles, in all but a small number of rare cases, are solely or even significantly influenced by single gene mutations like these. But there is a high likelihood, a certainty even, that more genetic underpinnings of personality will be identified in the coming years. Studies exploring the genetics of height, intelligence, and personality style show that we will increasingly be able to decode the genetic components of even our most intimate, complex, and human traits with growing accuracy. Even if we don't fully uncover the genetics underpinning these traits for many decades, we won't need such a complete understanding to deploy our limited but growing knowledge of genetics in both our healthcare and reproduction with increasing confidence. We will shift gradually from our generalized healthcare based on population averages to precision healthcare based on responding proactively to our genetic predispositions. Perhaps even more significantly, we will begin to integrate these genetic predictions into our reproductive decision-making. The human implications of having these choices were what made you uncomfortable as the doctor outlined your options in the fertility clinic based on her advanced but incomplete knowledge of how genes function. Even with this limited knowledge, however, each of us will, in one way or another, need to decide whether or not we will sign the doctor's tablet. Making these kinds of decisions in the 2035 clinic will have a relatively low safety threshold compared to what will come after. Each of these embryos in 2035 will be the natural and unedited offspring of the genetic parents like you. Even if our understanding of genetics proves completely wrong, all parents using IVF and traditional pre-implantation embryo selection will wind up with a child as natural as any other. But at a time when hacking biology is becoming the new operating mode of our species, there is little chance our application of genetic technologies to the reproduction process will end with just selecting from a few pre-implanted embryos.